Now, this book is, in a sense, a prequel to what I become later on. And it's a formative experience. I had very little to do with the decision to go back to the Soviet Union. That was my father's decision. And it was a very divisive issue because my mother didn't really want to go. They'd both come to Melbourne in 1937 and 1938. And she was not Russian. She was from Poland and Belarusian. And so for her, it was a choice of either splitting the family and staying in Melbourne or keeping the family together and going to the Soviet Union. Even though they were both active communists, in a sense believing in it, even though they were not official members of the party at that time. So that's part of the reason why it starts. It doesn't start there, but that's one of them.
When I was reading the book, one of the great pleasures of it was its invocation of the vanished world of the inner city left of the 1940s and the 1950s. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that. If we were to jump into a time machine and travel back to Carlton in the late 1940s, how would the Jewish community we would find then differ from the Jewish community we know today?
Well, my parents lived in inner city, the northern suburbs in Fitzroy and Carlton when they arrived. They worked in factories around that area. They were working class, self-educated communists of that period. So in contrast to, say, the post-war period where you have students and, you know, various academics and others who mainly made up many of the party members in that period, the party was made up of real working class, self-educated people who learned to read, and they were very keen on reading and reading books and educating themselves. The paradoxical situation between the 40s and early 50s and today's Jewish community is that North Carlton was called Little Jerusalem, but it was a predominantly secular community. And there were all these communists, Bundists, members of the Labour Party. There were religious people, but all the people that kind of gathered at the Kadima in Lygon Street, which of course many years later became the Aeolian Club, Santa Maria, the most prominent member from the Aeolian Islands, and they moved to Elsternwick. But prior to that, Carlton was very much a secular, politically left Jewish community. And the real difference is that everybody, paradoxically, supported the founding of Israel in 1947-48, even Trotskyists, can you believe it? The only ones who opposed it were the Bundists, who had been anti-Zionists from the early decades. And so it's paradoxical to see Bundists today, like Michael, who came from a Bundist background, Michael Gawenda, who come out and support Israel, whereas at that time, most of the people supported. You know, one of the reasons was that Stalin was the leading supporter of the founding of Israel. And without Stalin's help sending arms to the 700,000 new Israelis via Czechoslovakia that were secretly smuggled in, the new state of Israel would not have probably survived, because they were attacked by 27 to 29 million Arab countries at that time. So, and well before Donald Trump wanted to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in 2018, Stalin was the first person to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. It was a totally different era then. And it was when the Soviet Union changed its policies towards Israel, because it supported the Arab states, Nasser had come to power in Egypt and so forth, that the actual changing role of Jews in Melbourne started to become evident. And so, in many ways, the Jewish community in Australia is a microcosm of the cultural and social changes of the larger society. And as many Jews ceased to work in factories and offices or whatever and became invested in, you know, got their little businesses and real estate and that, they became more affluent. And even though they carried on left traditions, a minority, most of them became quite conservative. And that's the story.
Describe your mother coming to Australia via Paris. And there is a terrific scene in the book where she passes, having arrived in Melbourne, she passes through the inner city and she is aghast at this parochial backward place at which she's arrived. And I've read similar accounts from other memoirs of European immigrants to Australia. So my question to you is, what role did the Communist Party play in fulfilling the cultural aspirations of people like your mother and your father? How did they fill that niche?
Well, my mother was raised as a Bundist in Grodno in Belarus, but the Bundist community was fairly small in Melbourne, and so she became active in the Communist Party. And she, there is one or two photos that shows her being part of the large Eureka Youth League and Young Communist League camps that were at Barwon Heads or at Hillsville or various other places, and it provided a totality of kind of life for people, in that it was both cultural, political, the social network was developed, and people really knew one another through that network. Yes, it was significant. And of course, my father, not of course, I discovered this, he acquired a Soviet passport in 1947, and the Communist Party in the Carlton branch said, you can't be a member anymore, because we don't want anybody that's not an Australian citizen for us to be tarred, you know, with the brush of being agents of Moscow. So even though he ceased being an official member of the Communist Party, he was still very active. And that, of course, he harboured this desire for many decades to return back to his boyhood Kerch in Crimea.
In 1956, your father decides that he wants to take the entire family from Melbourne to the Soviet Union. Now, this is not unknown. There are lots of narratives of people in the West deciding that they want to become part of the so-called workers' state. A lot of those narratives are significantly earlier, and this is quite late for that sort of rosy idealism about the Soviet Union. What I found particularly fascinating was your subsequent discovery that your mother was quite hostile to this idea and had argued stridently against the proposal of your father to take the family back to the Soviet Union. So I wonder if you could tell us what it was about your father's politics that made him susceptible to Stalin's propaganda as late as 1956, and conversely, what it was about your mother that made her able to see through that, at least to some degree.
Well, I wouldn't say that she was able to see through it entirely, because she also believed that the Soviet Union was the society of the future. But she was, I suppose, more sceptical than my father. And as he described himself, I was a maniac, he said. I was a fanatic. And he was blind. We left after Khrushchev's secret speech in early 1956. But it was not known in this country. And when ASIO came to our place in East St Kilda under the guise of wanting to buy Russian records, a conversation cropped up about whether Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin. And my father said, with most of the people in the Communist Party at the time, it's just lies from the capitalist press. It couldn't be true. The real story came out several months later. By that time, we were already in the Soviet Union. So it is an interesting account of delusions. He genuinely, because my father was part of the Australian Soviet Friendship Society, and he actively organised each Sunday evening Soviet films at the Carlton Bughouse. And he taught Russian to students alongside Nina Christensen, who was herself Russian, and she set up the Russian language department at the University of Melbourne. But the two of them would teach Russian And this book is really about the unknown people. My father wasn't known. But ASIO and the government all knew him very well, and this book is based on hundreds of files from the government departments. And the other thing is, it raised a question about how do you write about people who are relatively unknown? Most history of the left, of the communist or other left parties, is really often focuses on their kings and queens and the princes, and rather than on ordinary people in the party. There are other books that write history from below, and that is based on largely oral history, interviews with former or current members trying to get that. But if there is no oral history, how do you actually write? And it's there where memoirs become very important, about if you've lived through certain experiences. And that's why the book is both a combination of biography, personal memoir, and a lot of historical background detail.
Well, that brings me to my next point. So in 1956, you and your family travel to the Soviet Union. One of the points you make in the book is that there are many accounts of life in the Soviet Union in the 20s and the 30s, and there are comparatively many accounts of the final years of the Soviet Union, but that period in the 50s, which really was the era in which the Soviet Union established itself as a superpower, is relatively underrepresented both in the academic and popular literature. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what it was actually like to be in the Soviet Union during the Khrushchev era.
Well, let me simply say that we were incredibly lucky to arrive 3 years after Stalin died, because this book would never have been written, and my father and mother would never have seen daylight. And we came in a period where the terror was being closed down. That is not to say that our encounters with many of the local and regional officials, there was a mixture. Some were the old Stalinists, and as they said to us, if I had my choice, I'd put you against the wall and shoot you, instead of, you know, giving you the right to leave. So, you know, this, and the others were living in a kind of, the books, as I say, and the book is not really, our experience of the Soviet Union was not like the kind of fictional or theoretical positions that George Orwell and others depicted in 1984. The Soviet Union at the time was a very vibrant society. Vibrant in the sense that there were infinitely more political jokes and critique of the government than you would find in any Western capitalist society. I'm talking about at everyday level. Every day and every week, people were saying something that was incredibly critical. But of course, they said it privately. It was not, you know, permitted to say it publicly. And so these years from 1956 to 1960 were the transitional years. And as you mentioned, Jeff, much more has been written about the Brezhnev years or the Stalin years or the Gorbachev years, but very little on those years in the late 50s.
I'm interested in the dynamic within your family. Like, I remember when I was a kid and my parents wanted to move me from one suburb to the next, and I found that to be absolutely unbearable. Your parents moved you from not only one country but one social system to the next. And at the same time, your parents were divided about whether this was a good idea or not. Once you arrived there, you discovered it was actually a terrible idea. So how did your family stay together with all of these tensions, and how did they play out when you were there in the Soviet Union?
Well, it only took a matter of a couple of weeks before we were recognised virtually in the first day or two, but it took my father a couple of weeks. He still believed, oh, things couldn't be this bad, it'll prove, wait till we get to so-and-so. And then after the penny dropped, we all agreed that we were going to band together and develop a strategy of how to get out of the country. Of course, it took us 4 years to get out, only because we were born in Australia. And it took another 3 years for the Australian government to let my father back. And what people don't realise is that they talk about the contrast between the free world and totalitarianism, but in reality, the Russians had already wanted to let us out, but Menzies and his government under ASIO, under Spry, refused to let us back in. And that was the paradoxical situation. So for those who haven't lived through, didn't live through the Menzies period, it was a very authoritarian regime. And you couldn't read things, you couldn't see things. Most people, as I mentioned in the book, what I found particularly shocking is that each year from 1951 until 1971, ASIO, in conjunction with military intelligence, fearing the outbreak of a new war, had a list of between 11,000 at the peak and 5,000 men, women and children to be rounded up in detention camps or concentration camps. And this list was only known to the Prime Minister, the Minister for Defence, the Minister for Immigration and the Attorney General covering ASIO. The whole cabinet didn't know, because if the whole cabinet knew that these lists were there, there would have been absolute, that would have been a public scandal. And Australia has a long history that if your name was Italian or German or whatever, you were locked up in the First and Second World War as a so-called enemy, even though you, the real fascists were not necessarily locked up. Yeah. So that's the strange thing about Australian history. And today, when you read that, and migrant, all the heads of the migrant communities, children, they were all on the list. We don't know whether our family was on the list or not. Yeah. Probably.
Well, to follow on from that, I feel like a lot of people, and in fact you describe this in the book, a lot of people would have concluded the Australian government during the Cold War would have been absolutely thrilled to have got a family who had originally thought the Soviet Union was a workers' paradise and then be disenchanted to come back to Australia. This would have seemed, you would have thought, to be a great propaganda victory. But in fact, that wasn't the conclusion that they drew at all. They weren't keen to get you back. Why was that?
Well, just to slightly correct that, the archive documents reveal that there were real debates inside immigration and PM's department external between those deputy secretaries and others who said, we want them back because it'll be a coup. You know, we can publicise. And Alexander Downer, not the senior, the far, and Menzies, and of course Spry, mainly head of ASIO, they said, no, we can't afford, these people constitute a real threat. And they made a blank, you know, kind of thing, we will not permit other families that left to go to the Soviet Union to return. And it took, I won't reveal the thing, but it took my sister and I, a particular escapade in Moscow that changed the whole direction of our ability to leave.
So you, spoiler alert, you eventually made it back to Australia, and some years later your father did as well. I'm interested in how your father assimilated this experience. When he was back in Australia and he was dealing with his old communist acquaintances, how did he put this all together in his mind, that the place that he had thought represented a workers' paradise had turned out to be completely opposite to what he expected? He was now back in Australia. How did that work out for him?
Well, from genuinely believing that it was a good thing for us to go to the Soviet Union because we would get a real good education compared to the education we got at Brighton Road State School, and that we would get all the culture and everything. From believing that, and that this was the workers' state, to total disillusionment with politics. And then by the time he returned, he was only a young man, relatively speaking, of about 55 going on 56, 55, 53, beg your pardon, 55, and he couldn't mix with the right wing. He never became right wing, but he refused to mix with the old people that he knew on the left in the Australia Soviet and the Communist Party and so forth, because he still, as he said to Asia, they're maniacs and like me. But he said, if communism becomes a genuine form in the future and becomes really cooperative and shares all these things, then I might become a communist again. But at the moment, you know, and they were shocked about this, you know, and this report, you know, went up, and they refused to give him naturalization when he applied until the last year of his life, when a spry was gone and a new head of ASIO was there. But there was a real vendetta between Charles Spry, the head of ASIO, and my father. And we were subversives, and you'll see in the report, even we children were regarded as subversive because they reported that we were going around telling all the other kids that there's no God, there's no Father Christmas, and so forth. And this is all written, you know, these people are undermining the social structure.
Well, that brings me to something that I was wondering about the entire time when I was reading, which is to do with your own politics, because a lot of people who've had a similar experience to that would have ended up on the Cold War, right? In fact, there's no shortage of accounts of God that failed narratives, people going to the Soviet Union, yep, thinking it's going to be terrific, coming back and then deciding, okay, communism is a failure, I'm moving to the Cold War, right? You obviously didn't do that, otherwise we wouldn't be having this conversation. Why not?
Well, I felt there were essentially three groups. The stringent, virulent anti-communists from their experience, the people who retreated to music like my father did, or tending your garden like others, and then there were the third group who tried to learn from the experiences, because both communist Soviet Union was a mockery of socialism, and capitalism was also inherently against any form of equality and all the other aspects. And so I took that third path, and I learned a lot by working for 6 years before I went to university. So it was at working full-time in factories and offices and stores and all the rest of the things that I saw both sides of the class structure in Australia. And it's only through those experiences that and the Soviet Union that enriched me politically, even though we suffered a lot while we were there. So it's that's part of the reason. And so I was very lucky to be able to go to university in 1966. And at that point in time, for most people who are not aware, 82% of people in Australia between the ages of 18 and 24 had not even finished high school. This was a country that was profoundly uneducated in the form. And it was only, and the Whitlam years never made up for that, even though they, but when you think of over 80% had not gone to finished high school, and only about 3% of males and about 1.5 to 2% of females had gone to university prior to that. So it was a society that helps explain why the arts are so impoverished in this country, why science is so neglected, because the level of education and the support for governments who could ignore education, the myth that Menzies did fantastic things for building up education, was nonsense. We ranked at the end of the Menzies years and the Gorton and McMahon years, we ranked next to Turkey on the OECD ladder in terms of poor level of expenditure. And so we've never recovered to this very day, despite the attempts of governments to increase levels of education. Now we have the other problem. We have plenty of people in formal education, but the humanities and the sciences are in a parlous state. Yeah. So We've gone from one extreme to the other.
Your title, of course, is double-edged. No Country for Idealist refers to the Soviet Union, but also refers to the Australia of the 1950s. Obvious question is, Australia 1923. Is it a country for idealists?
I don't know about 1923, but 2023.
1923 is a much better song.
Yes, definitely. I mean, the ideas, what's happened to our public institutions in the past 30 years is testimony to the fact that to be an idealist, to hope for something better in this country, puts you very much in a tiny minority. We think, you know, we're part of a growing majority, but those days are yet to emerge. And we are still in a country that values the dollar and the practical skills much more than ideals. So we've got a long struggle ahead.